It's time once again for Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for 5 years has shared with us her extensive research into political assassinations and abuses of power in this country. Her program relates the news of the week to emerging evidence about the conspiracy which allegedly maintains by force its control over the legislative, executive, and judicial processes in America. And now, Mae Brussel.
Good afternoon. This is Mae Brussel in Carmel, California. It's Dialogue Conspiracy number 252, and this is January the 17th, 1977. A very beautiful day in Carmel. Cold in the east, but lovely out here. I want to give a few moments' time to reflect upon the murder of Gary Gilmore this morning. He was shot by the firing squad. I've heard a lot of discussion on talk radio today about justice being served, about the two people he killed. And yet, if you've listened to my shows the last few months, I've spent quite a few moments talking about Gary Gilmore. And I would like just once more to bring up this subject and leave it for a while, hopefully, but share my feelings about the subject. I believe that Gary Gilmore was programmed in the Oregon State Hospital. He got special treatment in a special treatment center. He was the victim of massive electroshock. He had been chained to a bed. He was not allowed out. And while he was sane, he asked his lawyer at the time of his trial, "Why didn't you bring up at my defense the fact that I had to kill those two gentlemen in Salt Lake City, that I had no choice?" The last death, the execution in the United States by death penalty was 10 years ago. The last death in California was a black man who was screaming, "I'm innocent." His name was Mr. Mitchell. I believe that the killing of Gary Gilmore was a media CIA operation. The motive was to clear the way for execution of many political patsies or otherwise innocent people who could get what we call swift justice and be killed by the gas chamber or the firing squad or electric chair. I believe that this white man was chosen for a reason and that he shot at random and asked for the firing squad so that the majority of people on death row who are black or Indians, Chicanos, will be made to appear as cowards. I believe that he was used to test the mind control as a future kamikaze, as an individual. He was given specific drugs, which were combined with beer, that caused his violence. And the name of those drugs, which I have at home, would be interesting to test in conjunction with beer on some other person in a test situation. At the time of the Altamont concert in California, where the Rolling Stones were singing and a gentleman was stabbed and killed, Mr. Meredith, right on cameras while the music was going, the Hells Angels had been given drugs that were made in a laboratory in Berkeley combined with beer that caused them to go insane. And there were multiple beatings, and there were four deaths that evening, and one was photographed and put into the movie Gimme Shelter. The Gary Gilmore story will also make a movie. The biggest problem in the United States and in the world, I feel, is the control of the minds, the war on the minds. I think it's the most important thing that's happening in this 20th century. I think it's as important as the making of armaments or atomic bombs. I believe it is more devilish and more evil to use a person's mind, whether it's media on brainwashing or even, say, a small child in their home or the collusion of teachers teaching them misinformation or wrong information in a school. But with the alteration of drugs and psychosurgery and brain implants, electrode implants, and radiation to alter a man's thinking and hypnotism, I think we're in an area that was paved, the way was paved by Adolf Hitler and the German psychiatrist, and then they came to this country and continued it. And it is diabolical. It is horrendous. I don't know what to say about it. I believe that the war of the minds is terrible because outer space seems so far away. Man goes aiming to the moon or into space or space weapons or to shoot each other down with satellite rockets. But our mind, our brain, our memory is our own personal thing. Each person is born unique and his memory is unique. And when the state takes it over and gives you a pill or a knife through your eyes for lobotomy or implants electrode in your head and then instructs you behind a machine, that is such an invasion of privacy that the government should stop it, but they don't stop it. I read an article just this Sunday that a man in San Francisco, literally a alcoholic bum walking the streets, was taken by NASA to a deprivation place to study, just keeping him in bed day after day to see what it does to his muscles and his brains, particularly his muscles, so that when men go to outer space and can't be walking on their feet, how their body responds to the lack of stimulation between the joints. But they take a person who's poor, who's homeless, maybe uneducated, an alcoholic, and instead of rebuilding his own individual privacy into the decent human being he could possibly become, and questioning how he got on the streets as this gutter, just sitting on the gutter, occupying it, sleeping there, NASA took him and put him in a bed and experiments on him. To top the Gilmore story this week, there was the movie on television, national television, on the Whitman boy who shot from the tower in Texas. And this was one of the first incidences of political use of a brain as an excuse for further experimentation based upon a faulty premise. The TV show announced that the Whitman boy had a brain tumor, and this is why he did the killing. He did the killing because he was in the Marines, because he worked with police and FBI officials, and there never was any proof that he had a diseased brain, and the brain doesn't exist today. The CIA and the FBI were in on the Malai case. The same judge from the Malai massacre that worked with William Calley and others was on the Gilmore story, the Lawrence Schiller. The author who worked with the CIA continuously and still does is to be the author and the recipient of the movie rights of Gary Gilmore's story. Schiller surfaced immediately after Lenny Bruce was killed, and I fingered that as really the beginning of the murder of political movie people, and they're continuing even through today. We'll talk about a murder that took place this week. I believe that Lenny Bruce was the first instance of killing a political entertainer and making it look like an overdose of drugs. Then Larry Schiller went from there to the set of Marilyn Monroe and infiltrated that set and got pictures of her nude and was able to get the early Marilyn Monroe story right off the press as soon as she was dead. He showed up with Jack Ruby in Texas with a microphone hidden and concealed, getting conversations of Ruby with his brother that were carefully prompted and came out with a record about Jack Ruby, claiming there was no conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. He then went with Sue Atkins, who turned evidence against Charles Manson and the family, and now Lawrence Schiller shows up for a buck in Salt Lake City, Utah, as the person who's going to take care of the movie and the book rights of Gary Gilmore. The secret medical papers of his psychosurgery, his electroshocks, and his special treatment in Oregon were never made available to the people who tried to stop this sentence and the firing squad, even though a doctor with Gary Gilmore had been linked to a German in the Nazi extermination camps who worked over there and who was working in Salt Lake City. And next to Gary Gilmore was an FBI informer, a cellmate who sent out letters that were published in the newspapers the last few days and could possibly have been the source of drugs for the suicide attempts that became dramatic and kept him in the news not one time but twice. If he was able to get drugs in the prison the first time and almost died, depriving us of this blood spilling in Salt Lake City, it's very strange that a second time around with cameras on him and no girlfriend to come see him and nobody who could possibly give him drugs, that Gary Gilmore got drugs a second time. But when you find that his good friend, cellmate close by is an FBI informer, you know that that man can have access to the drugs that Gilmore took the second time. The media is not through with the Gary Gilmore case. This evening, Bill Moyer will do a television show on Gary Gilmore, The People versus Gary Gilmore, and of course is being produced by CBS News. That's the news company that does the famous Cronkite shows that Lee Harvey Oswald killed John Kennedy and there was no conspiracy. I understand that Mr. William Paley is considering stepping down to make Henry Kissinger president of CBS, which is all we need for a national news media. Bill Moyers was described in Who's Who in the CIA in 1952-59. He was a propagandist for the Pentagon and the CIA. In 1951-61, he was an advisor to Lyndon Johnson, first as a senator and then vice president. And after John Kennedy was killed, he became deputy director of the Peace Corps, just at a time when John Kennedy's baby, the Peace Corps, became infiltrated with a nest of CIA spies. So you have an Army military intelligence judge. You have doctors linked to the Nazi doctors' extermination camps. You have a media project on CBS done by a CIA newsman, Bill Moyer. You have FBI co-cellmate of Gary Gilmore. You have a government money funding to, that went from the Pentagon to the Oregon State Hospital, where this particular person was a patient in the secret records. And I think that, as I say, it's a tragic thing that the circumstances under who was handling the Gary Gilmore case and who was doing the special treatment in the hospital and what kind of treatment he had should have been investigated, because I think he was programmed to say that he wanted to die and he wanted a blood spilling in this state, because this is the only state of the 50 that does that, that ritually does blood spilling, because it's a religious state and the Mormons believe in spilling blood for blood. And it's a state heavily infiltrated with CIA agents and members of the Defense Intelligence Agency. The script is a total wipeout, and that's why it's so sad. I feel sorry for the two people that were murdered, but I feel that we can't protect ourselves against these senseless crimes. They're called motiveless or senseless unless we stop the programming, because everybody walking down the street is a potential target if the government is programming people to kill. And that's why it's so important to go into the medical records and find out what happened to Gilmore. But his brain and body are not available. He was cut up, went to a hospital 25 miles away, and every part of his body that was available was cut up for science, and the bones will be buried wherever the family wants them. So even in that case, we can't get to his head to even see if there's an electrode. The gentleman has been sliced by now, and it's too late. Meanwhile, in the news along those lines, I see there's two other murder cases that don't get the same treatment that Gary Gilmore gets. One was just in today's news about a father murdering his son. He murdered his pride and joy. It was in Texas, Oregon City, Texas. A man named Mr. Griggs murdered his son October 31st. He folded his hands on his chest when the boy was asleep, the man, and put a bullet in his temple. And he said the reason he did it was that he had dropped out of school and he was taking courses, correspondence courses, but he was taking marijuana. He wasn't on anything like a needle or heroin, but he took some pills and he took marijuana and he drank cheap wine. And the father said that he was my pride of boy, pride and joy. He was a good boy. He was a good athlete. He was easygoing. And when he dropped his sports activity and let his hair go too long, he wanted to finish school, and he did by correspondence. But his father wasn't happy with that. He said he wasn't a drug addict. All he had was Valium and marijuana. So he went to the room and got a .22 caliber pistol, and he shot the boy in the head and killed him. And he said, I don't care about the consequences. He's better off dead. Well, there was a trial in Texas this last week, and the jury deadlocked 9-3 in favor of an acquittal. And the neighbors came to him, two different men, and said that after the trial, they had also thought of killing their own children. So the man is free. He's on probation. He wasn't sent to jail. A man is 18-year-old, is old enough to go to war to defend his country. His father has the right to own him. Evidently, when you give birth to a son or daughter, you must have the right to own them and kill them, because they acquitted him and didn't like the marijuana and the long hair. That was the reason for shooting the boy, the man, and the father was acquitted. He's on probation. And Claudine Longette was found guilty of charges in Aspen, Colorado, of murdering her lover this last week. And she said that she intends to go back to teaching elementary school. She's been teaching French songs to second graders. The children think she's great. She was convicted of criminal negligent homicide in the death of her lover. But she said that she intends now to go back. The trial's over. She'll go back to teaching school in the second grade. She wasn't home on the weekend. She has a very expensive chalet there in Aspen. She was spending the weekend with rock star John Denver or movie star Jack Nicholson. And maybe she'll be back teaching school as soon as her sentencing. So there's a little difference in the justice here in America of what happens when one person kills and is taken off and drugged and programmed, and when other people are allowed to kill their own son or their lover and they are found to get a very slight tap on the hand. The problem with the death penalty and the firing squad is that so many of these cases get off. I heard today on the news that Jane Russell's son, he killed a Mexican farm worker in Santa Barbara. And he got a sentence of 9 months, and he'll be off. It seems that the law allows you to kill members of your own family or minority people or lovers, whatever you want. If you are up a certain economic bracket and you're well known, murder is allowed. And this is one of the reasons I feel so very strongly against that death penalty. Well, last week on Dialogue Conspiracy, I talked about Richard Nixon and the Nazis. I think I could do many, many weeks on that subject, but I'll do a little more this week because I want to bring out a few people that Nixon has honored and the importance of the Nixon Nazis, because I'm not talking about World War II, 1945-46, but how they're affecting us right now today. I talked, just to review just briefly last week, I talked about a gentleman named Nikolai Malaxa, M-A-L-A-X-A, who supplied steel and rubber and ammunition to the fascist Iron Guard in Romania and Eastern Europe. He shouldn't have been allowed in this country because he was a war criminal, but he joined the OSS, picked up several million dollars, and came to the United States. Before he came over here in 1936, he had gone to Berlin and became the business partner of Albert Goering, Field Marshal Hermann Goering's brother. He was a staunch war criminal without any doubt or question about what role he had in Europe at the time of the war. As I say, he picked up reparations for losing his ammunition factory when he was supplying Hitler and Eastern Europe with arms and picked up several million dollars. Came to the United States. He didn't have any single redeeming qualification for coming here except that he was a good Nazi war criminal. He entered the United States and his immigration papers were signed by Undersecretary of State Adolf Burley, who was Nixon's co-worker in the Alger Hiss case. That's the man who worked with Whitaker Chambers, who helped to nail Alger Hiss, who at the time he was linked to Whitaker Chambers, was fighting the rearmament of Germany, and men like Mr. Malaxa. The junior senator from California, Richard Nixon, introduced a private bill into Congress in 1951 to allow this good Nazi into the United States. And when he came here, he picked up another million at Chase Manhattan Bank in New York City. And his net worth then was about $3 million. And he came out to Whittier in 1951 and formed a dummy front called Western Tube in Whittier, California. His address was 607 Bank of America Building. Herman Perry, vice president of Western Tube, the Nazi dummy front, was also vice president of Bank of America. And he's the man who also recruited Richard Nixon to run for Congress against Congressman Voorhees in 1946. I'm reviewing this with you because it is such a strong link of Richard Nixon to Nazis in the past. Nixon's law partner, Thomas Bewley, became secretary of this dummy front, the Western Tube. When there was a question of whether Malaxa could stay in this country or not, Nixon was the one who got the Defense Production Administration to say that he was important for building parts for oil tubing for the Korean War. He got a special first preference petition as a permanent resident in the United States. From there, Malaxa, Nazi, Mr. Nikolai Malaxa, went from Whittier, California, where he set up a dummy front, to Argentina in Buenos Aires, where he met with another Nazi, Otto Skorensky, member of the Iron Guard and member of the Odessa and Worldwide Nazis. This is important because when you read news articles such as one that was in the San Francisco Examiner just yesterday, and you see what's happening to Central and South America in terms of statistics and what America is doing to contribute to the publishing and the revival of Nazism, just trace one man and realize that literally hundreds and hundreds were taken from Germany, in addition to Mr. Malaxa, taken by Richard Nixon's partners and sponsors down to Buenos Aires. The military rule in South America right now controls 8 out of 12 South American countries. With the exception of 4, they're all going totally Nazi and are in the hands of military dictatorship. These 8 countries are engaged in a total war against international Marxism, which was the excuse that Adolf Hitler gave for confiscating personal property and individual lives. And they are conducting down in South America what is called a war of the minds. National security, Seguridad Nacional, is the remedy, the keyword for these dictatorships taking over. We have to protect you from communists. This is what Hitler said when he went into Romania and Hungary and Poland and Yugoslavia, France, Belgium, Italy, South Africa, and these many, many countries. The national security excuse was used when John Kennedy was killed, and our great Earl Warren, the Chief Justice, said, We would never know for 75 years who killed John Kennedy because it was for reasons of national security. Countries such as Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, and Uruguay received these Nazis. They were taken by the Pope and the Cardinals out of Italy with millions of dollars, as well as Mr. Sadat, I mentioned, in Egypt, who was in Nazi intelligence, and many of the Arab leaders and the Shah of Iran. Argentina alone this year has had 1,400 political murders. Every possible politician or leftist sympathizer is being routinely slain, and Argentina has bragged or claimed now 1,400. And every day, if you read your paper, there's one killing in San Francisco, one person on the streets, two in Argentina. The battle is racing each other for deaths on the street, but Argentina lost 1,400. They jailed 20,000 political prisoners in Argentina on the basis of reforms or land reforms or press. Chile jailed 100,000 prisoners, and there are literally thousands of missing persons in Chile. As soon as the ITT and Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger and the various powers that be overthrew Allende and put in this particular government in Chile, the Nazi flags came out, Mein Kampf came out, and the Nazis were in business overtly in Latin America. And then Argentina was the second country after Chile to show its Nazi fangs this year, burning the synagogues and Jewish homes and businesses. One out of every 60 people in Uruguay is now jailed for political crimes. One out of every 60 people that is working to organize or even to publish anything exposing this is jailed for political crimes. Paraguay has 2,000 people that were arrested just this last spring for political reasons, and some of them have been held in their prisons for 18 years. They can't be heard or seen. They're in there for 18 years. Bolivia and Brazil have been accused of torture. It's common. It's widely documented. Chile has been accused of torture, and the torture is being made by American instruments, and the police are being trained in the United States, in Texas, and Washington, D.C. Latin America is now experiencing brutal military repression, identical to Nazi Germany, and the excuse for national security allows these military dictators. After the Nazi defeat in Germany, the Nazis were resurrected in Latin America through the taking of money and gold and counterfeit paper money and taken down to the military schools that were run by Americans and Latins. They say they were trained in America, sent down there to take care of the peasants and the middle class. The weapons for all this and the money are sent from America. The World Bank just recently sent a huge loan to Chile just last month, in spite of the fact that torture is documented and the police training is documented as having come from the United States. And there is even a report that people were given a shot, a poison. They're released from jail, and 3 years from now, their kidneys will shrivel. That's in Chile. Weapons come from America. The nation in these 8 out of 12 countries is considered absolute. They're saying there's no limitation to their absolute power. It's a new movement, as I say, between Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Paraguay, Peru, and Uruguay. The army is privileged. Everyone in the army is privileged. It's identical to the Nazi doctrine that the state has to expand and defend itself and that the rights of the individual are a myth. We have this at the Boston Hospital, Yale, of Dr. Delgado, who says that the right of a man to have his own mind is a myth. And this is where the kamikaze and the suicide training began, by taking away man's right to have his own mind. And Congress, the congressional records have heard the testimony of Dr. Delgado, and the government has funded his experiments to take away from man his individuality. In the Latin American countries, the people exist as part of the state. They have to serve it and defend it or have arrests. The total war against the individual has brought massive arrests, and not only the revolutionaries, the people actively political in like a labor organization or a communist front, but anybody who sympathizes. This includes labor leaders, journalists, clergymen, university students, and professors. Now, the problem with this situation in Latin America is that it's very difficult to comprehend because it's so far away from us. But if you take a list of people that are being killed in this country systematically, which I try to do with rock musicians and judges, and what I consider political slaughters, I blame it directly upon the Nazification of America, which began when Richard Nixon was at Navy Intelligence and Howard Hughes and Charles Lindbergh were working with Adolf Hitler, and were sorry that he lost the war and imported these Nazis into this country and allowed this Nazification to take place. These terror squads are not unlike the kinds of terrors which we're seeing here, but which the American people are not able to identify with. Cases like the Chowchilla case, which I've referred to as being caused by a link to the Zodiac killers and the International White Guard, where they test massive kidnapping, control the news media. These men haven't gone to trial. They don't match the people that were described. The Chowchilla case, to me, is a typical example of American terrorism, similar to what the Ustashi did in Yugoslavia and Croatia. Emily and William Harris haven't gone to trial yet for kidnapping Patty Hearst. It'll be quite a few years since she was kidnapped, and they're up in Oakland, and you don't hear a word about that trial. William Harris was responsible for stealing some socks that caused the shootout in Los Angeles. Six of their comrades were burned. You don't hear a thing about that trial. It's at a stalemate. The terror takes place. The SWAT team is introduced. The arms are on the streets. The Harrises have yet to go to trial on that. Jeffrey Hubbard, the son of Ron Hubbard, the founder of Scientology, was found unconscious in his car in Las Vegas, Nevada. His father went to Nevada just recently. This was in October this year, 1976, October 28th. He failed to respond to treatment. They don't know how he died. No cause of death. Ron Hubbard, no matter what you think of Scientology, you may have your opinions for or against it. I'm neutral on this subject. I know that Ron Hubbard has been the strongest foe against Nazism, German and American, living today. And one of the strongholds of this Nazism is in Las Vegas, Nevada. And when his son was traveling through for whatever reasons, he was found near the Air Force base in Las Vegas in his car, and no explanation of his death. A judge, John F. Bianca, died at the time of the prosecution of Peter Riley, this young fellow in New England that Arthur Miller went to length to overturn the case and defend him. He's charged with murdering his mother. But this judge died at the time of the prosecution, and a new judge came in. There were gaps in certain tapes that were taken. Perjury was allowed. Falsification of evidence was allowed in the case, and a judge died at the time of that trial. Another judge died when James Earl Ray said there was a conspiracy down in Memphis, Tennessee, where he killed or was charged with killing Martin Luther King. He said it was a conspiracy, that he didn't do it, and at the time that he wanted to tell Judge Battle died. When James Earl Ray had a new trial in Cincinnati and new appeals and wanted to open up the case, and a Judge Miller was favorable to him, a Judge Miller died on the case. Another case of Murderville that's going on that I think links to these was broke in the news after Don Bowles was murdered in Arizona just this week. A John Adamson, who was arrested, claimed that he was hired for the purpose of killing Don Bowles, and he confessed to that. But the dogs that hired him weren't just satisfied with one murder. And this is the range of people, the kinds of people that can be murdered by just one man. He was also hired to kill three other people. One, the Attorney General Bruce Babbitt in Nevada, in Arizona. Another was Al Lesensitz, a demonstrator who was objecting to the liquor industry, the liquor lobby in Arizona. And he also has information about the beating of a talent scout named Les Boros in Scottsdale, Arizona. So John Adamson has a wide range of people to kill. Don Bowles, a newspaper man and the attorney general of the state, an anti-liquor opponent, a talent scout. And yet when you get a cross range of people dying, like rock musicians, labor leaders, judges on a case, district attorneys, it's hard for people who listen to Dialogue Conspiracy or read the news every week to realize that one man can be used for a wide range of murders that don't seem related to you necessarily, but which are related. And the masterminds behind each one of these cases have a reason for murdering these people. And I don't believe the control of the murders is in the hands of a lot of people. But there is, like the Iron Guard in Europe, there is this International White Guard, this group that does have permission of the FBI, the CIA, or the police department to do these murders. And the only reason they're not caught is because the police department covers it up and the DA. And when a man starts to talk, such as in the Oblonsky murders, Joseph Oblonsky family, when a man begins to talk, or Mr. Adamson begins to talk at the time of his trial on the Don Bowles case, then the story breaks open. It doesn't break open because the police want it to break open, or the district attorney wants it to, or the attorney general of the state. The court system only tries those people identical to Nazi Germany who are put on the spot, and there are not very many of them because most of the buddies in this thing stick together. Well, I've been studying a long list of people that worked with Richard Nixon that I'll mention a few of them that came in the White House, hardcore Nazis. But a famous Nazi was just in this country. He came over here in November. That was 2 months ago, and he was here again last April. His name is Hans Ulrich Rudel, R-U-D-E-L. Hans Ulrich, U-L-R-I-C-H, Rudel. Rudel was Hitler's favorite Nazi pilot, Air Force pilot. In World War II, he was the greatest flying ace that lived that Adolf Hitler had. He was active after the war in neo-Nazi activities. And this year, in 1976, in November, the U.S. generals from the Pentagon invited him to participate in seeing our new jet fighter, the A-10. The Air Force invited him. It was built by Fairchild Industries. And nobody in the Air Force will say who invited him, but he came to this country. Rudel claims that he knocked out 500 Soviet tanks during World War II at the time the Soviets were our allies and Hitler was the enemy. And adding fuel to the fire, he was the world's leading expert on airplanes, and the Pentagon wanted him here to see our fleet and give advice about our fleet in 1976. He was decorated by Hitler's Air Force. He sunk a Russian battleship. He led raids and dive bombers into Rotterdam and Warsaw and leveled them. In 1945, that's when Hitler gave him the highest decorations. And then when the war was over, he surrendered his airplane on an American airfield in Bavaria and became the darling of the reconstruction of Germany after World War I and World War II. That's why people like Otto John, the German citizen who wanted to weed out the Nazis, were discredited and taken out to the government by our CIA, because the OSS and the CIA were meeting with people like Hans Ulrich Rudel and giving them a position of prominence in Germany. Rudel represents right now Western German and American companies in South America. He still travels between America and South America. If you wonder why those eight countries are becoming more and more Nazified with Mein Kampf getting out and new books coming out. He was viewed after the war as an unrepentant Nazi. He stayed active in the Socialist Reich Party, which is neo-fascist. He was banned from his books from young readers, school children, because he's still so Nazi. He's a strong rightist, and he was allowed into this country this last November to view our jet planes, and then goes with his Nazi mentality from our Pentagon down to Latin America, where he represents these companies. The same gentleman, Colonel Hans Ulrich Rudel, was in Chicago in April of 76. So he comes quite frequently to the United States. He came here in April, and he came here again in November. And he worked with the Odessa, the Nazi SS officers who were planning to rebuild the Fourth Reich. He was described in Ladislas Farrago's book, Aftermath. Pages 185, 186. It says the Jesuit priests helped the Nazis escape. Rudel began to start with a large electric manufacturing firm, which is his dummy front, and he visits his office or station in Chicago, and he works with a manager of a restaurant in Chicago. He is a Nazi who has never repented, who works between Germany, our Pentagon, Chicago, and Latin America, and he's very active still with Nazism, and the old Nazis have not died by a long shot. Many people think the war was a long time away, but it wasn't. And for some of you who never ordered the Senate hearings at the time of the Watergate, the Senate Select Committee on the Investigation of the Watergate, I brought to read to you some pages about a former member of the Gestapo who worked for Richard Nixon in Miami at the time of the Watergate to show you the wide variety of services these people can still perform. This is from Book 11, The Presidential Campaign Activities of 1972. A witness was called by the name of Robert Bentz, and he testified that he lives in Lutz, Florida, and he's a member of the Young Republicans. I'll skip this and read you some of his testimony. He's a member of the Young Republicans Club down there, and he was hired by Donald Segretti for the purpose of disrupting the Democratic conventions and have hecklers and pickets and infiltrate the campaigns in 1972. Donald Segretti gave him money for this job. He worked for him, and he acquired pickets at the rallies where Richard Nixon was, and trying to discredit Nixon and making him think the Democrats did that. He hired pickets, and he hired people to bother Senator Muskie and discredit him by making remarks that Senator Muskie was against blacks, and he began his racism in sending out letters about Muskie and his racial slurs. Mr. Benz was asked about a man named Duke that he hired as a provocateur in the Miami area for the 1972 elections, and they asked him about Mr. Duke. Mr. Lenzer from the Senate investigating staff said, "Did you know anything about his background?" Mr. Benz said, "Well, he told me he was a former member of the Nazi Party. Did you discuss the possibility of using him to disrupt Muskie's train and furnishing false information about the schedules?" He said, "Yes." "Did you make signs for Wallace?" He said, "Yes, such as, 'If you liked Hitler, you'll love Wallace.'" They wanted to turn people, the Republicans, against George Wallace so that Richard Nixon would get the Wallace votes. And they also worked with the American Nazi Party to register the Wallace people against Richard Nixon, get the votes for Richard Nixon. They had signs that said, "A vote for Wallace is a wasted vote." They made 500 or 1,000 of these, and then they made signs, "Help Muskie support busing our children," so the Southerners would believe that Muskie wanted racial integration and vote against him. They sent letters out saying that Senator Jackson and Humphrey were homosexuals. This is Mr. Benz, the Nazi. And they had picnics where they invited people. There was no food, and they sent food where people were not invited, and the Democrats were charged with the bills. And then they sent food with picnics. It said, "Going back now to the picnic where chemicals distributed. Did you tell the FBI who interviewed you in this May of this year for the Muskie picnic on Sunday and a chemical was distributed?" And he said, "That is correct. And you sent it into the picnic area?" And he said, "I didn't do it, but Mr. Benz was helpful." This Nazi from the SS Gestapo, he goes later and testifies, worked with Adolf Hitler and the Gestapo, was sending chemicals into the picnic area where people had lunch for Mr. Muskie. And the commission didn't ask what chemical they used. There could be some poison that would get into their system later. But that question wasn't asked. And they asked him about other demonstrations that he did and working for Donald Segretti. And Mr. Benz was hiring this Nazi to work with him, and he knew that he was from the Nazi Party. They circulated information, as I say, about the homosexuality of campaign people such as Hubert Humphrey and Senator Jackson, and used their stationery. They broke in the office and used their stationery for this kind of activity. Then Senator Talmadge said, "I believe you had two subordinates helping you with this kind of work, throwing chemicals in buildings, chemicals at picnics, and so forth. One was named Mr. Duke, and the other one was Mr. Herring. Is that right?" And Mr. Benz said his name was Duke. And Senator Talmadge said, "Did Mr. Herring tell you that this man Duke was a former SS officer for Adolf Hitler's stormtroopers?" "Correct." "Did you feel that being trained by Adolf Hitler and his stormtroopers particularly qualified him for the duties that you assigned to him?" Mr. Benz said, "I don't know of any training school that would train him for this work. Were not the activities quite similar? Did not Hitler's Nazi stormtroopers perform similar activities to what you were engaged in Florida?" "I wouldn't know that, Senator." Senator Talmadge said, "You have read some history of the period, have you not?" "Correct." "You read The Rise and Fall of the Third Reich, I take it?" "Correct." "Are not the activities of the Nazi stormtroopers, what you did in Florida, similar?" "I don't recall if he ever did that or not." "I thought they were. I read a lot about this," said Senator Talmadge, "a lot of falsified documents during the era of Hitler and labels and slander about their opposition. It was one of the ways, as I recall, that Adolf Hitler achieved power. Do you think Duke carried on his activities in an exemplary fashion in the manner? Do you?" And Ben said, "Yes, sir. He distributed misleading information. He sent fake invitations to non-existing events. He issued false press releases. He sent stink bombs through offices. He circulated libelous and untrue letters to injure the candidate of the opposition party. He defiled the phone bank. He carried on this chemical warfare at a picnic." And Senator Inouye said, "Do you consider ordering supplies, food, beverage on behalf of an opposition candidate with no intention of payment as being legal, ethical, or moral?" And he said, "No, sir." "Do you think disseminating this information, false and scurrilous attacks on these congressmen should be continued. And he said, no, but I was not justified, but I was prompted. And Senator Ervin said, well, Cain felt it was proper to kill his brother Abel, and he didn't offer much justification. So Hitler didn't leave Nazi Germany. He was down in Florida multiplying his little solutions, his final solutions to political control, even in Florida at the time of the 1972 elections. And you're going to be reading a lot in the news in the next months to come about the deportation of Nazis. Many Nazis came here beginning in 45, 46, brought by the FBI, brought by the CIA, all over this country to hospitals, schools, universities, particularly defense industries. But when certain people caught on to the fact that they signed an oath saying they'd never belonged to the Iron Guard or never killed people in extermination camps, that was a legal loophole because they were not supposed to come in as Nazi criminals. So in order to make their entry into this country perfectly kosher, the government, the State Department, and Richard Nixon passed through the Immigration and Naturalization Service a new law in 1952, which made the deportation of suspected Nazis almost impossible, because the new law said that you could not deport a man because he was a Nazi. And this is a quotation from the law. It holds true even if he did the most horrible things. So Nazis that came into here after 1952 probably can't be deported, even if they lied about whether or they were Nazis or not before. And there will be deportation proceedings on maybe 50 to 7 Nazis who came into this country immediately after the war through the OSS and CIA, who are living fairly quiet lives, and we don't hear much about them. There is an interesting gentleman whose name came up with regards to the research of my assassination. His name came up just in the news this October, and I've never heard about him through the years, the last 12 years, except for this one article, and his name is Frank Nage. And a large article came out in the Washington Post that he lives on a farm in Virginia. He's got a large farm, 12-room home, 130-acre dairy, and he lives with his family, and he came over here. He was the premier of Hungary, and he came here in 1947. And according to the Washington Post article, he brought nothing with him from Hungary. But according to the Torbett document, the allegations of an alias of a lawyer in the Southwest, Frank Nage was named as the man who had the umbrella at Dealey Plaza. And it said that he had a gun that the CIA has confirmed they've made inside of umbrellas, that when the umbrella goes down, the gun goes off. And Frank Nage was allegedly at Dealey Plaza. The story is that Edgar Hoover brought him to this country and gave him millions of dollars, several millions of dollars, and that he was one of the people at Dealey Plaza. And the researchers have never been able to show the interest to look for him, locate him, compare his face to that umbrella man 13 years ago. I now have a picture of Frank Nage, if we could blow up the picture of the umbrella man at Dealey Plaza. But when we read that Mr. Maloxa, Nikolai Maloxa, landed here and was given $3 million from the OSS, the State Department, and Chase National Bank, it's possible that Nage did come and get millions of dollars when he came here from Hungary and did serve a purpose at Dealey Plaza, because the story in the Washington Post is that he's earned the money for this large farm and home by lecturing and writing. And to my knowledge, I've never seen a brochure, an instance of where he lectured in this country. Correct me if I'm wrong. If any of you have ever heard him give a public lecture, it would be interesting to write to the State Department or the Internal Revenue and find out where his money came from and which colleges he did lecture at, because maybe his money didn't come from lecturings. Maybe it did come from Dealey Plaza, like these other refugees and these other Nazi sympathizers. Well, our time is up. Once more, I could talk for hours on Nazis in America that are affecting us today, but I think you get the point. Be sure to read that book by Mr. Blum on the search for the Nazis, and I have a good bibliography of books on the Nazis. If you contact me, I can copy it off for you. That's it for today. This is Dialogue Conspiracy
in
Brussels in Carmel, California, and I'll see you next Monday.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for many years has been researching the facts behind political assassinations and conspiracies in this country. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.